So the starting point of my lecture is the title of the conference, rather fittingly, The End of Western Hegemonies. And as the call for papers makes clear, as we've seen in various panels so far, there are several indicators that may be taken to point in the direction of an end of Western hegemonies. We see emerging powers, especially China, challenging America's status as superpower. Books abound that see a post-Western world order on the horizon, the end of American world order, and a global future that is Asian rather than Western. We also see a rise of populism, fake news, so-called illiberal democracies, a sea change in transatlantic relations where commentators see the post-1945 settlement of the transatlantic order severely undermined, if not destroyed. We see the rise of an America First mantra that questions the role of NATO and that pits America against the notion of a Western value community, irrespective of what the American president said two days ago at his state visit to the UK. We see a rediscovery of Oswald Spengler's Decline of the West and the American New Right, and also a renaissance of the geopolitical thought of Weimar Germany's most prominent anti-liberal thinker, Carl Schmitt, and we heard about him just this morning. We see the revival of other anti-Western fantasies from the interwar period when looking to the East. In one of the panels after lunch, Jussi Backman will offer his thoughts on Alexander Dugin's vision of Eurasianism. And finally, we see surprisingly close ties between Russia and the former campaign staff of the American president, now thoroughly investigated by special counsel Robert Mueller, and also vividly described in Timothy Snyder's recent book, The Road to Unfreedom, in which he quotes a Russian politician hoping that Trump can lead the Western locomotive right off the rails. A rather interesting statement that also reveals the close relationship between notions of the West and philosophies of history. Snyder, of course, sees Putinesque demons rather than a Hegelian world spirit wandering from East to West. Now, as Marie-José pointed out in the kind introduction, my perspective on the subject of the West is very much informed by the history of concepts, and it is this angle that I will take in my lecture as well. And I should add that parts of my lecture are based on research that I've done with my colleague Martina Steber from the Institute for Contemporary History in Munich. So my argument would be that while we may be witnessing the end of Western hegemonies, though the organizers, of course, have been careful enough to put a question mark behind the title, there are still hegemonic notions of the West, which are, in fact, more alive than ever. Of course, as the call for papers rightly states, as long as there have been Western hegemonies, there have been contestations of them. And one could add that as long as there have been hegemonic notions of the West, there have been contestations of them. And we heard, in fact, some very interesting examples of such contestations in Cecilia's keynote yesterday, and we'll also add a couple in a minute. However, it is worth pondering that the end of Western hegemonies goes hand in hand with a remarkable resilience, if not resurgence, of the West as a socio-political concept. Firstly, the West continues to be a highly popular and effective framing device, and secondly, there is a perseverance of hegemonic notions of the West that have a long tradition and reach far back in time, until the early 19th century, or what Reinhard Koselleck, the German historian of concepts, called the Sattelzeit. It may well be that an extra effort of defamiliarization, as it were, is required to gain sufficient distance to common patterns of interpretation, but I do believe it is remarkable that a range of quite disparate phenomena, such as the rise of populism, the economic boom of China, and backroom deals between Russian officials and former associates of the American president, are almost automatically framed in terms of a crisis, decline, twilight of the West, which in turn, of course, reinforces the West as a prominent point of reference in political debate and the wider public sphere. Western hegemonies may have ended in various areas of life, but the West as a rhetorical pattern is very much alive. Current debates show, in fact, that the concept of the West proves useful even, and perhaps especially, when commentators lament its crisis, decline, twilight, or end. Indeed, one could argue that the greatest threat to the West as a sociopolitical concept is the lack of any threat. It does tend to be in fashion when confronted with internal or external threats that are considered anti-Western. The renewed prominence of the West as a sociopolitical concept has a lot to do with the self-assertion of anti-Western alterities, the prominence and distinctiveness of the other, which may come in various shapes or forms. For quite some time now, both militant Islamism and an increasingly autocratic, imperial-minded Russia provide alterities robust enough, as it were, to keep the West alive. In a post-Cold War environment where the former antonym, Soviet communism, has vanished. Likewise, when confronted with the transnational challenge of populism and anti-pluralism, staunch defenders of liberal democracy frequently resort to the concept of a liberal democratic West, and they do so as a sense-making strategy, a rhetorical tool to mobilize people, and also as a device to stabilize identities. So what I want to do in my lecture is first to give a few examples of Western self-assertion and attempts to stabilize Western identity, which I will then contrast with some of those contestations I mentioned, i.e. self-positionings beyond the West and attempts to dismantle the Western paradigm. Second and more central to my lecture, I will outline an analytical framework that may help us explore discourses on the West more systematically. And in order to illustrate my points, I'll be continually drawing on the work of the most prominent advocate of the West in Germany, Heinrich August Winkler, although there may be a good intellectual rationale for focusing on the work of this particular scholar. The main reason for choosing him is my own academic socialization, because it's really through the intensive debates revolving around Winkler's two-volume bestseller, Germany's Long Road West, published in 2000, that, as it were, I found my own way to the West. So third and finally, I will go a little further back in time and explore the Westernization of the political thought of two German remigre scholars who happened to be hugely influential for the formation of Winkler's historical and political thinking. And there I take my cue from the end of the call for papers, which points to the importance of examining why and how it occurred that the West enjoyed strong leadership in certain domains. And again, I'd like to explore this question from the perspective of the history of concepts. There is an extensive literature that is committed to stabilizing Western identity. A few book titles may suffice to illustrate this, which all point in the same direction. For instance, The Uniqueness of Western Civilization, Rebooting the West, How the West Won, or The Fate of the West, The Battle to Save the World's Most Successful Political Idea. And all these books seek to boost Western confidence and self-assurance at a time when, for one reason or another, the West is seen under threat, in crisis, or in decline. and one of the most vocal supporters of the project to reboot the West is the British historian, political advisor, and media star Neil Ferguson. Ferguson laments what he calls the pusillanimity of Westerners. They are, he says, beset by nagging self-doubts and a value relativism instilled by a postmodern, post-colonial questioning of Western paradigms. They are therefore unfit for the political and economic challenges of the day. Ferguson is a real master of knowledge transfer, keen to reach a younger audience. And in his 2011 book, Civilization, he outlines six killer apps of Western power. And these killer apps are meant to explain the West's rise to world dominance, purportedly starting in 1500, brushing aside arguments of other scholars, such as Kenneth Pomeranz, who believe that the great divergence between Europe and China did not happen before 1800. So at a time when Westerners have downloaded most of the West's killer apps, heralding the end of the Western era, Ferguson's message to Westerners places great emphasis on reactivating killer app number six, the Weberian work ethic, which provides the moral framework for Western civilization. In a nutshell, Westerners should pray more and work harder. Udo De Fabio, a prominent legal scholar and former judge of Germany's constitutional court, makes the case as well for a reappropriation of a Western value, such as individual freedom, practical reason, and the Weberian work ethic. He reflects at length upon Western culture, Western value system, and most importantly, the West's cultural self-endangerment, a cultural crisis. And the notion of a cultural crisis of the West is nothing new. Our Westerners have worried about the cultural cohesion and inner strength of their civilization for more than a century. And I will, in fact, come back to that theme towards the end of my lecture. But it's fair to say, I think, that with Samuel Huntington's Clash of Civilization and the 9/11 terrorist attacks, as well as the fear of becoming economically outpaced by China, the subject of the inner fitness and cultural self-awareness of Westerners has gained a new urgency. Now, at the same time, and already hinted at this, cosmopolitan self-positionings beyond the West cast doubt on the West's status as cultural entity, or what Arnold Toynbee called an intelligible unit of historical study. The West, they say, has lost much of its intellectual plausibility, and they fundamentally challenge many of the formerly unquestioned assumptions about what the West represents. In his 2016 Wreath Lectures, philosopher and cultural theorist Kwame Anthony Appiah debunked the whole idea of the West and declared there is no such thing as Western civilization. And his Wreath Lectures, by the way, can be read as an answer to Neil Ferguson's Wreath Lectures from 2012, which had warned against a degeneration of Western societies. Particularly, Appiah argues against any claims of exclusive ownership over so-called Western values, not least because of the global exchange and cross-fertilization of ideas. Cultural constructs such as Western civilization, he points out, might become a form of confinement, conceptual mistakes underwriting moral ones, unquote. And Appiah is a prominent example of a broad strand of post-colonial literature which radically questions the epistemological status of the West. An even more forceful version of the strand of thought offers Pankaj Mishra, especially in his more recent books, Age of Anger and From the Ruins of Empire. From the Ruins of Empire reminds readers of the critique of European colonialism, which was formulated by Asian intellectuals around the turn of the century. Already before publishing these two bestsellers, he had caused a stir by attacking Neil Ferguson's killer app book in a long article in the London Review of Books, something that Ferguson answered with threats of a libel suit. Now, when we take a step back and look at current debates on the West more generally, there appear to exist two types of conflict. First, between advocates and opponents of a liberal democratic West, and second, between supporters and critics of the West on the one hand, and on the other, cosmopolitan, post-colonial self-positionings beyond the West. And if you want to analyze these various conflicts and make the process of Western identity shaping as well as contesting a subject of inquiry, I suggest maybe worth dwelling a bit on two aspects that I think are crucial for an analysis of the West from the perspective of the history of concepts, which brings me to the second part of the lecture. I will first explore what I think are two key semantic dimensions of the concept of the West, and will then examine the function, appeal, and usefulness of that concept. In the discourse on the West, there's often a tension at play between an open-ended evolutionary concept on the one hand, and on the other, what we may call a spatially confined container concept. The evolutionary concept implies a universal trajectory and a standard of civilizational progress, and we also already heard this actually in Marie-José's lecture today. So a standard of civilizational progress in terms of social norms, technical advance, economic development, political values. So a standard of civilizational development or progress that in principle is attainable by every part of the world. The underlying assumption is the existence of one single universal civilization that originates in the West, with a special emphasis on the so-called Atlantic revolutions of the late 18th century, and a cluster of norms and values centered on human rights, the rule of law, separation of powers, parliamentary democracy. Democracy is located in the West, but the assumption is that sometime in the future, the West will be everywhere. The West is placed at the apex of human progress and civilizational development, but at some point in the history of humankind, everyone will have joined the march of Western modernity. This evolutionary concept of the West conveys meanings of temporalized space, or what some human geographers call time-space. And this is most obvious in terms such as westernization, but it's also evident from statements such as Hegel's that world history is traveling from east to west, for Europe is the absolute end of history, just as Asia is the beginning, unquote. And the key message of this temporalization of space is that moving westward means moving forward. The container concept, instead, is largely defined along cultural, religious, linguistic, and also ethnic lines. It is therefore constituted by features that, even in principle, are much less universalizable. Apparently there now is such a word in the English language, but correct me if I'm wrong. So this concept implies a plurality of civilizations with different trajectories and only a limited degree of convergence, if any. And the classic example would be the notion of a historical West or the Occident, what the Germans call the Abendland, as an area dominated by Latin Christianity as opposed to the world of Eastern Orthodoxy. And to illustrate the point that thinking in terms of religious East-West divide is still prevalent in today's political commentary, I'd like to give you a nice quote from the popular Today program on BBC Radio 4, which is from the height of the Greek government debt crisis 4 years ago. On the 30th of June 2015, which was the day where Greece became the first developed country to fail to make an IMF loan repayment, The commentator on the Today program drew a parallel between, I quote, the respective attitudes of the Greek and German governments towards debt redemption and the respective attitudes of the Eastern and Western churches towards theological redemption. And this is what he said. The dominant Western theological model of redemption is basically that of debt repayment. It goes like this. Human beings have sinned against God and thus incurred a debt that has to be repaid. But because this debt has become impossibly enormous, Jesus comes and pays it back on our behalf. That's what happens on the cross. And it's not insignificant that Angela Merkel, who insists that the Greeks must repay their debt, is also the daughter of a Lutheran minister for whom this debt repayment model would have been the very essence of the biblical narrative. But the Greek Orthodox Church sees the salvation story completely differently. For the Eastern Orthodox Churches, the key event is the resurrection, not the crucifixion. Indeed, they see the idea that the cross is some sort of cosmic payback for human sin as a sort of no pain, no gain obsession with suffering. For one thing, they are not into sin language, and for another, they do not believe that a God who can cheat death must abide by the strict logic of the Western payback model. It may look like the argument between Greece and Germany is simply an argument over money, but look deeper, and there's a whole difference of worldview. And it's there in their prayers as well as in their banks. Now, as mentioned at the beginning of the lecture, I'd like to illustrate the tension between the evolutionary concept and the container concept of the West by discussing what is the main work of German scholarship on the subject, namely Heinrich August Winkler's four-volume, The History of the West. Winkler is emeritus professor at the Humboldt University in Berlin. He has been the most well-known historian in the German public for quite some time. So if there's one historian people know in Germany, then it's him. It's also to do with the fact that he has long left the proverbial ivory tower, and that his target area has been very much the wider intellectual field where citizens search for political guidance and moral leadership. Political education has really been the primary impetus of Winkler's work, especially over the past 20, 30 years, and it is no wonder that Winkler, as an intellectual, frequently speaks out on matters of general concern, such as European integration, Russia's annexation of Crimea, the war in eastern Ukraine, and many other things too. So the political implications of Winkler's work are obvious, and he himself makes no bones about the normative angle of his scholarship. Winkler's The History of the West was published in 2009 till 2015 and runs to more than 4,500 pages, a concise, crisp, and up-to-date summary of this magnum opus will be published in September, which will only run to 900-odd pages. Before that, he, as already mentioned, he had published a two-volume bestseller, Germany's Long Road West, which keeps it just under 1,500, and which became a defining work for a unified Germany 10 years after its reunification. So Germany's Long Road West really gained the status of a master narrative of the Berlin Republic. The pivot of Winkler's story is what he calls the normative project of the West. The American Declaration of Independence, the French Declaration of the Rights of Man of the Citizen at the heart of it, the norms of this project are mainly derived from ideas advanced by these two so-called Atlantic revolutions, as mentioned before. Winkler's History of the West is both the story of the emergence of this cluster of Western values and the story of their appropriation, rejection, or violation. While critics of Germany's Long Road West were quick to point out that Winkler reviewed German history against the ahistorical yardstick of an idealized West, he has now followed the French, British, and Americans too on their circuitous paths to the West, through the muddy waters, as it were, of imperialism, racism, and slavery. The Westernization of the West, he declares, was a process marked by non-simultaneity. Some became westernized faster than others. And there were many contradictions between project and practice. The Western project itself, of course, remains unblemished, and Winkler's West leaves hardly any room for the dialectics of the Enlightenment. As can be inferred from Winkler's notion of a westernization of the West, the term the West carries various meanings, and that's the crucial point here. It refers not only to a normative project, but also to a geographical region preceding this project. There was a West before the West. And as in this debt redemption commentary, Winkler's historical West, Occident, Abendland, is defined as that part of Europe where Latin Christianity held sway, and it ends where the influence of the Orthodox Church begins. So only those Europeans oriented towards Rome were Westerners, and those under the spell of Byzantium were not. In Winkler's liberal understanding of the historical West, Abendland is the separation between religious and secular powers that was critical to Western evolution. Give to Caesar what is Caesar's, to God what is God's. This statement, he claims, contains the possibility of this very separation between religious and secular powers, which was, he says, only realized in the Occident and which marked the beginning of many more separations of power to come. Winkler's Occident, in other words, is a space defined by the principle of separation, this principle which the historian Otto Hinze once described as the dualist spirit offered an essential precondition, he says, for the development of individual freedom. The West paved the way for the West, the normative project. And the crucial point here to make is that the conflation of evolutionary and container concept leads to limitations of the universalizability of Western ideas. Sometimes the drawing of civilizational boundaries remains implicit and works more like an unspoken assumption. Sometimes it is made explicit, for instance, when commenting on the war in Eastern Ukraine, Russian politics in general, also the question of Turkey's accession to the EU would be another example. And it's those dynamics of exclusion which are built into Western container space rhetoric that are criticized from post-colonial and cosmopolitan perspectives beyond the West. Critics take exception to the exclusive link that is made between space and idea. For instance, when people are referring to Western democracy. What's important to bear in mind is that both conceptual variants, evolutionary concept, container concept, are not mutually exclusive, but often coexist in varying degrees of conflation, which create tensions between the West's universality and Western particularities. And this brings me to my second aspect, the function, appeal, and usefulness of the concept. The West is not only a cipher for political values, cultural norms, religious traditions, it's also an effective rhetorical tool to mobilize people for a cause, to fight for a political agenda, and to forge national as well as transnational identities. And what I think needs to be recognized here is the spatiality of the concept. We need to take seriously that the West is a spatial concept. This may sound incredibly basic and maybe a very obvious point to make, but I do think it's worth pondering because it is a point often left underexplored, I think. Spatial concepts, once they metamorphose into socio-political ones, and as mentioned at the beginning, for the West, that happens at some point in the early 19th century. So spatial concepts in this specific sense are distinct from non-spatial ones in their specific ability to reduce complexity, create orientation, and shape identities. And by specific ability, I mean the homogenization of space. Spatial concepts create orientation and shape identities through spatial homogenization. They evoke an imagined community and create a sense of cultural, historical, ideological cohesion, which is, and that's significant, attached to a certain geographical area. Sometimes the boundaries of this area are defined very clearly. Often they are amorphous and they also tend to shift over time. And once again, Winkler's History of the West, as well as earlier work, Germany's Long Road West, provide a very good example. The creation of this multi-volume monument is a performative act to anchor Germany firmly in the imagined community of the West, i.e. in a community defined by liberal democratic pluralist values. And that's the political rationale for producing such a work in the first place. Germans should care about the West because they belong to it. And that's the central message no German is supposed to miss when browsing in the bookshop. After centuries of fateful deviation from the Western norm, so the argument goes, Germans have finally arrived in the Western haven, and Winkler has written nearly 6,000 pages to make sure nobody ever forgets. The English-speaking book market, of course, has been liberally supplied with histories of the West for more than a century. In the US, since the introduction of the Western Civ curriculum in the aftermath of the First World War, but Winkler's History of the West has been the first of its kind written for a German audience. Like his bestseller, Germany's Long Road West, this work explains to German citizens who they are, where they come from, and where their commitments lie. A key purpose of Winkler's History of the West is to remind Germans of the country that has been the driving force behind what he calls the normative project of the West, namely the United States. And the cover image of the second volume of his History of the West, which culminates in the Allied victory over Germany in 1945, aptly visualizes this aspect of Winkler's message. Raising the flag on Iwo Jima, the historic photograph showing five US Marines and Navy corpsmen raising the American flag on Japanese island in February 1945, has been one of America's most popular icons and works here as a symbol for Winkler's message that Western values are grounded both in Western European and American history. US history-based values must form a moral and intellectual lodestar for German citizens. The West, in other words, creates a space of imagination in which, and here I quote Winkler, the values that evolved in the US, starting with the American Declaration of Independence, can be conceived as one's own values, i.e. the values of German citizens. The spatial concept of the West works as a bridge that not only connects one body politic to another, but that facilitates the formation of liberal, democratic, pluralist subjectivities. The key function is the internalization of political values through the self-positioning on a mental map that is oriented to the West. Political identity formation through spatial homogenization. While Winkler is the first one to write a history of the West in Germany, he follows in a tradition of previous German Westernizers. His scholarship and intellectual commitments reflect the legacy of a whole tradition of Western missionaries who all left their traces in his work. And this brings me to the third and final part of my lecture, where I explore the Westernization of political thought of two German remigres, scholars who proved, as I said at the beginning, hugely influential for Winkler. And what I'd like to draw attention to with this case study is this. When historians embark on the historicization of the West, they rarely address the question of when, how, and why certain historical actors appropriate this concept. Particularly, the rationale behind the spatialization of political thought often remains underexplored. I would argue, however, that this question is important if historians are to gauge the appeal and usefulness of spatial concepts such as the West. What were the advantages of using spatial concept? What was the difference between political languages that were spatialized and those that were not? And which historical contexts facilitated or indeed required the use of particular spatio-political concepts such as the West? My case study draws on another of my research areas, the history of academics, and looks at Ernst Fraenkel and Richard Löwenthal, two scholars who emigrated from Germany in the 1930s and returned to Germany after the war. And both of these academics, through the course of exile and remigration, first transformed into ardent supporters of Western democracy before embarking on their mission to westernize the Federal Republic's political culture. And by westernizing, I mean the incorporation of West Germany into a value community called the West. And again, this conceptual history component is important here. This value-based incorporation was to go far beyond so-called Westbindung, the integration with NATO. It was to drag German society away from what was perceived as the murky currents of a German special consciousness characterized by, well, you name it, yeah, authoritarian statism, anti-democratic nationalism, and the ideal of an apolitical government that would represent an allegedly homogeneous organic body politic called the people. And this incorporation into Western value community consisted of what was called a democratization of the state, which meant a greater degree of political participation, the public negotiation of conflicting viewpoints, the acceptance and affirmation of the pluralist makeup of modern society, and other things too. Now, we'll address two guiding questions in this final part of the lecture. First, in what ways did the political thought of these two intellectuals spatialize, i.e. incorporate and or modify spatio-political frameworks? And second, which spatial contexts were key to this transformation and what part did shifting spatial identities play in this? Now, who were these two academics? Ernst Fraenkel was born in 1898, studied law, joined the Social Democratic Party, worked as a lawyer in Berlin. He fled Nazi persecution in 1938, emigrated to the United States, studied American law in Chicago, from which he graduated as a 42-year-old in 1941. He was naturalized 3 years later. When he came to West Berlin in 1951 to teach at the refounded German School of Politics at the Free University, he did so as a U.S. State Department consultant for education policy, working under the auspices of the High Commission for Germany. Soon, Fraenkel became professor of political theory and comparative government at the Free University, and by the mid-1960s, his theory of neo-pluralism, most prominently outlined in his widely read collection of essays, Germany and Western Democracies, had become one of the most significant intellectual foundations of the Federal Republic. In 1961, Fraenkel was joined by Richard Löwenthal. Löwenthal was appointed professor of international relations with a strong emphasis on world communism. Born in 1908, Löwenthal studied law and economics. He joined the Communist Party, but was then ostracized because he didn't toe the new party line that declared social fascism to be the party's main enemy. In 1933, he joined a left socialist resistance group called New Beginnings. He soon had to leave Germany and spent most of his exile in London, where he started working for the news agency Reuters and was later hired by the liberal weekly The Observer. In 1947, he became a British citizen. I will now turn to the process through which Fraenkel and Löwenthal appropriated the spatio-political framework of the West. And simply put, the question I'm asking is, how and why did their political thought transform? The transformation of Ernst Fraenkel's political thought has been the subject of some debate. Most scholars tend to agree, however, that the theory of neopluralism, which he fully outlined in the early 1960s, harked back to his writings on democracy, which he published around 1930. So these writings, in fact, anticipated much of his later theory, Fraenkel's premise, for instance, that the people's will could never be stipulated a priori, but was always the result of a parliamentary compromise between the conflicting viewpoints of what he called autonomous groups, was an underlying assumption formed prior to his emigration to the US. Intellectual continuity notwithstanding, however, his time in exile did have major repercussions on the way in which he elaborated and framed his theory of neopluralism. The more he immersed himself in America's constitutional history and the more he learned about and experienced Roosevelt's New Deal liberalism, the more he came to shed his long-standing reservations about the American way of life. In his major monograph on American government, completed by 1959 and partially funded by the Rockefeller Foundation, he went as far as hailing the United States as the greatest work of art ever created in the Western Hemisphere. His great admiration for the US fed into his writings on neopluralism, which became based on a dichotomy between Anglo-American and continental European traditions. The former, the Anglo-American, representing the preferred model of parliamentary government and indirect democracy, and the latter, the continental European one, standing for what Fraenkel considered the chimera of a popular sovereignty truly realized through direct democracy. As a result of his time in exile, Fraenkel tapped into a field of academic knowledge that had been terra incognita for him and became one of West Germany's outstanding authorities in the field of American constitutional history. It was only after years following his remigration, however, that Fraenkel became an avowed Westernizer. From the perspective of conceptual history, his years in exile brought about an Americanization rather than a Westernization of his political thought. So while he continuously resorted to the concept of Western democracy from 1960 onwards, and that's a key point here, this concept had barely played a role in his writings before that time. His conceptual Westernization only occurred in the academic environment of the Free University Berlin with its direct exposition to the front line of the Cold War. It was only in West Berlin that Fraenkel's political thought became spatialized in terms of Western democracy. And this rhetorical transformation can, I think, be attributed to three key factors. And apologies for the slightly Germanic habit of numbering my points. They usually do come in three. In threes, but hopefully this helps make things a little clearer. So first, the question of Germany's historical relationship to the West, usually framed as the question of a German special path, featured increasingly prominently on the academic agenda in the mid and late 1950s. And it was a logical step for Fraenkel, primed by his Western background, as it were, to engage with the critical German special path discourse on German anti-Westernism. So as the notion of a fundamental dichotomy between Germany and the West still fueled what Fraenkel and others saw as a German special consciousness, both the term Western democracies and Germany's relationship to that space of political construct needed to be redefined and the imaginary geography of Western democracies needed expanding. He claimed that it would be wrong to confine the term the West to countries situated to the west of any particular demarcation line, such as the Iron Curtain. After all, the life work of Tomasz Masaryk was as central to the intellectual sphere of Western democracies as was the fight for freedom of the Poles in the 19th century or that of the Hungarians in the 20th. As for divided Germany, the entire nation could in fact belong to the community of Western democracies, if only it would explicitly align itself with it in an effort to make the boundaries of the West more fluid than they appeared to most people at the time. Frankl argued that it was up to individual societies to declare whether or not they would like to belong to the sphere of Western democracy. So we have an example here, obviously, of an evolutionary open-ended concept of the West. The rationale behind this voluntaristic way of drawing boundaries was to open up the discursive space of the West and to enable the citizens of the Federal Republic to fully participate in it, and thereby dissolving the old special path dichotomy between Germany and the West. Second, its frequent use of the term Western democracy was part of his art of persuasion. For the reasons I outlined in the second part of the lecture, Western democracy was a more powerful, vivid, and thus more useful expression than pluralist democracy or neo-pluralism. The conflation of a spatial concept and a keyword of political thought allowed him to anchor West Germany's political culture firmly in the realm of pluralist democracies and to make an effective case for its democratization. By spatializing a political ideology, he constructed a mental map on which West Germany was an integral part of the West. So more than once used the expression Western democracies, including the Federal Republic, or Western democracies, to which the Federal Republic belongs as well. An important point here to make is that the recurrence of such phrases in his writings from 1960 onward reveals Frankl's assumption that actually West Germany's embeddedness in the sphere of Western democracies was far from settled. Instead, he was still unsure and rather worried about the Federal Republic's moorings in the haven of the West. Those phrases implied, in fact, a polemical statement which was directed against anti-pluralist traditions still haunting West German political culture. Third and finally, Frankl's increasing determination to help transform West Germany's political culture manifested itself around 1960 in a shift in spatial identity. The self-declared American in Berlin, who had sworn never to use the word we again because he could never anymore identify himself with the Germans, suddenly switched to the we form again. And this was just around the time he started to avail himself of the language of Western democracy. He was still proud of his US citizenship, but from 1960 onward, he spoke of we, the Germans. This repeated transformation of spatial identity can be explained not only with this increasing commitment to shift West Germany's political culture westward and thereby forward, but also with this increasing identification with the Free University of Berlin as a place of knowledge transfer. This identification was fostered by an institutional self-conception as a hub of academic reform, political progress, and the transnational circulation of ideas. Frankl felt an increasingly strong obligation to both the Free University and the city of West Berlin, and was acutely aware of their precarious location on the front line of the Cold War. In times of crisis, he was careful to avoid any move, such as a prolonged research trip to the US, for instance, which might have suggested he would have abandoned the Free University. Frankl had become increasingly entangled with the whole Berlin problem, as he put it in a letter from January 1959, shortly after the outbreak of the second Berlin crisis. The American professor, as he had been called during his first years of remigration, had metamorphosed into a German Westernizer. A German Westernizer was still a loyal US citizen, but now also conceived of himself as an integral part of West Berlin and a steadfast defender of Western democracy. So I would argue that the full integration of the concept of the West in his rhetorical register allowed Frankl to solve an identity dilemma. Instead of choosing between two national identities, German or American, he transformed into a German-American Westerner. Frenkel's colleague, Richard Löwenthal, became a Westerner as well. The path of his intellectual journey, however, was longer and more circuitous. He started off as the member of a communist student association in the Weimar Republic and found himself signing up in 1950 as a founding member of the Congress for Cultural Freedom, a decidedly anti-communist organization and a major conduit of transatlantic cultural transfer that spread ideas of Cold War liberalism and Western civilization. Now, how can we account for this intellectual transformation again? Three factors stand out. First, the shockwave sent out by the Soviet Union. Second, the specific circumstances of Löwenthal's time in exile. And third, the emerging spatial logic of the Cold War in 1946-47. Typical of many communist and left socialist intellectuals, Löwenthal became increasingly disenchanted with the social experiment of the Soviet Union's Communist Party, while in 1936 he still praised the Soviet Union as a tremendously progressive state, freed from the fetters of capitalism. He increasingly castigated the totalitarian degeneration of Stalin's dictatorship. His critical stance to the Soviet Union, however, did not imply the embrace of a system of parliamentary government, nor did it include a more conciliatory attitude towards capitalism. It was only until the second half of the war, that he gradually abandoned his belief in a proletarian dictatorship as essential prerequisite of socialism. Now, emigration studies have stressed the importance of acculturation, the transformation of norms and beliefs through cultural contacts, and Richard Löwenthal provides a very good example for this process. From the middle of the Second World War, Löwenthal became a regular contributor to Tribune, Labour's independent weekly, and he also joined the newly founded International Bureau of the Fabian Society, a key forum of intellectual exchange to which he remained committed for many years to come. In interviews and autobiographical accounts from the mid and late 1980s, he remarked that his adaptation to life in Britain had fed into a second, a new identity. For the first time in his life, he had learned what it meant to live in a liberal, democratic country, a healthy democracy. Those were the days. Remarks such as these certainly smoothed over and simplified the complexity of his own intellectual transformation during the Second World War. For instance, he would not have used the term liberal democratic quite so emphatically at the time, but they underlined the significance of acculturation as a major milestone on his journey to evolutionary reformism and Western democracy. By the end of the war, however, Löwenthal had not yet fallen for the West. In his book Beyond Capitalism, which came out in 1946, he demanded the formation of a socialist Europe as a third force situated between the two world powers of East and West. And this demand was firmly rooted in previous socialist discussions and was part of several schemes of a European third force which were popping up like mushrooms in various political camps following the end of the war. The more evidently the binary logic of the Cold War began to crystallize, however, the less plausible these schemes became. His adaptation to the new realities of international relations manifests itself in an article he wrote for Tribune in October 1947, which he concluded by stating that communist intransigence was forcing socialists to confine their work to the martial sphere and to act as a progressive force within the Western world rather than as an independent third entity trying to mediate between the forces of West and East. Already in a letter from December 1946, he had pointed out that the conception of a third force, while envisioning a Germany independent of all occupation powers, did not imply neutrality between East and West, as long as West meant democratic Europe. Germany is part of Europe, namely a Europe to which Russia does not belong, unquote. So here already we see signs of a container space rhetoric that would become characteristic of Löwenthal's spatio-political framework. As he put in another letter, Russia had maneuvered itself into the dead end of world history, while America had the potential to develop in all directions. And there definitely is some truth in that sentence, I think. As so often in the conceptual history of the West was the increasing antagonism towards Russia that contributed to a westward shift of spatio-political imaginations. Löwenthal had certainly arrived in the West. His concept of the West, however, was not static, but dynamic, and provided a cipher for various visions of the future. So Löwenthal's use of the concept was certainly characterized by container space rhetoric, but if we quickly go back to the container image from before, Löwenthal's container was that red container at the top, a container on the move, as it were. So later he even highlighted this inner dynamic of Western civilization as a defining feature. Given his intellectual socialization at the University of Heidelberg, it's no wonder that his writings on Western civilization would owe much to Max Weber's theory of Occidental rationalization and the Protestant ethic of capitalism, and even more important was the impact of his political mentor, the Vienna-born historian Franz Borkenau, who was the former leader of the Communist Student Association that Löwenthal had joined in 1926. In the aftermath of the Second World War, Borkenau developed a strong interest in the evolution of Western civilization. Löwenthal, after discarding his preference for a socialist Europe as a third force, largely adopted Borkenau's spatio-political framework. And one of its key characteristics was a container space rhetoric that distinguished between a dynamic, creative Western and a static, invertebrate Eastern civilization. And again, particularly striking was the mental mapping of Russia, the creation of a timeless, fast-frozen image of barbaric Russian authoritarianism. And typical of the discourse of Western civilization in general, Borkenau was not merely concerned with the beginnings of the West, but also with its potential end. In 1947, he published an article in the British monthly Horizon, which carried the laconic title, After the Atom. In it, he painted the dark scenario of the real possibility of an atomic war, which would, even in the likely case of a Western victory, lead to the collapse of Western civilization. The assumption that this European heartland was already in a process of decline strengthened his belief that Western civilization, devastated by an atomic war, would enter an age of disintegration and relapse into barbarism in a manner similar to the demise of the West Roman Empire. Both Löwenthal and Borkenau were influenced, moreover, by the British historian Arnold Toynbee, who reached the height of his fame in the aftermath of the Second World War, at a time when the frequency of references to Western civilization soared. Toynbee's gargantuan multi-volume study of world civilizations, which to this day has remained unmatched, though probably not unchallenged, advanced the theory that Western civilization, alongside 20 other civilizations in world history, was, as mentioned earlier, an intelligible unit of historical study, a statement that was repeatedly quoted by both Borkenau and Löwenthal. When Löwenthal, and that's my final point, tried to make sense of the rapid transformation of industrial advanced plural societies from the mid and late 1960s, he resorted to a political language that was shot through with Toynbeean notions of rhythms, crises, and breakdowns of civilizations. From that time on, it was his mantra that the West was facing a cultural crisis, a situation of collective enemy. for him, the disaffection of the young Western intelligentsia with parliamentary democracy in 1968 was merely an epiphenomenon of a long-term cultural crisis. He was particularly worried about West-wide phenomena such as decline in work ethic and social cohesion, which in his view pointed to severe problems in identity formation, and far more serious than the abstract sloganeering of a great refusal during the student revolt, these symptoms of social decay revealed a serious cultural crisis that undermined the authority of Western institutions. Löwenthal's central goal was to preserve the system of liberal parliamentary democracy through stabilizing an identity nested in the narrative community of Western civilization. The language of Western civilization, closely intertwined since the 19th century with notions of progress, liberty, and rationality, was an effective way of negotiating fundamental values and the future of industrially advanced pluralist societies. Löwenthal articulated his observation of rapid sociocultural change by resorting to rhetorical patterns of crisis, demise, and the fear for survival. Patterns deeply inscribed in the language of Western civilization. At the same time, he deployed the Western crisis rhetoric as a means to create a sense of urgency, not too different from today's examples of Western self-assertion and attempts to stabilize Western identity, which I discussed at the very beginning of the lecture. Like more recent examples, the case of Löwenthal shows that the history of the West has always also been the story of a never-ending end. Thank you very much.